grateful to the organizers for scrambling to get me on the program, because it's unbelievable. But I was given a bad ticket and I ended up in Waterloo, Iowa. That's a bad joke. So I'm going to talk about spin, mostly about galactic black holes. So and these are my collaborators, and I'm going to talk rather fast. So a lot of it's in this review article up here at the top, which I'll cite again a few times. So this is measuring the spins of black holes, and the two methods that are working are the continuum fitting method here in blue. This is this review. And then the iron line method, which I'll talk about, and then I'll compare the results of the two methods. In the middle, if I have time, I'll mention two applications of our measurements of continuum fitting spin measurements. So these are the 20 of the galactic black hole systems drawn to relative scale. There's about 50 that are known. We have a lot of information on these 21 that are shown here. There are two classes. There's the persistent systems up here and the transient systems down here. So three of these persistent systems and 18 of these transient systems for which we have a lot of information. And this picture, these paintings, indicate what these two systems look like. And this is important for the talk, that there are two classes. Here are the persistent systems like Cygnus X1 you're familiar with, where the black hole is bathed in a persistent wind from the O star, and this thing goes on for thousands and millions of years continuously, as opposed to transients, which are fed from a usually low mass star through an accretion stream into a disk. And these will be on for typically a year and then off for decades. So like a volcano, due to the disk instability model, that's a description of why these things are on episodically, only for a month or so. So the transient systems, this is a light curve of one such system. When they have a major outburst, they go to Eddington luminosity, as indicated here. This is an X-ray light curve. And they're typically on for months or year or so, and then decades of dormancy. In a major outburst, they reach the Eddington limit. Where we measure the spin with continuum fitting is down here, not here, where the spectrum is heavily comptonized and very confusing, but down here, where the disk is dominant and the thermal component is the major component. These are optical and radio transients as well, and this shows the radio light curve of this system, so that at the very beginning, there are plasma blobs that are emitted on the plane of the sky. These are not the little steady radio jets you may know about. These are the episodic and infrequent blobs of plasma that move out on the sky. And they go out to parsec scale and are the analog of kiloparsec scale radio jets. So the continuum fitting method, it's pretty simple. The idea here is that one has the accretion disk and that the ISCO, we identify it with the inner edge of the disk, and we have good evidence for doing that, so that the disk truncates quite sharply at the innermost stable circular orbit, which is related to the spin parameter, as indicated here, whereas if spin is zero, you're at 6m, and if its spin is maximal prograde, you're at m. The idea of this method is very simple. Again, you can get this in the review article in a lot more detail, but it's just like measuring the radius of a star you can't resolve. If you can measure the flux and temperature of the star, then you can express the solid angle of the star on the sky, the radius divided by the diameter of the star in terms of the observable's flux and temperature. If you have the distance, you can estimate the radius of the star. This is incredibly simple astronomy. And we do the same thing, except we're using X-ray flux and temperature, and we're using the solid angle of the disk, and we can estimate this inner radius, this inner edge of the disk, which we identify with the ISCO radius, which is simply maps to the spin parameter, A star. So we measure our ISCO. We have to have M because we have to scale the size of the black hole, and we can infer the spin parameter by that curve I just showed you. We need accurate values of mass, inclination, and distance to do this, because we're dealing with luminosity, just like the analog of the star. And we need the mass to scale, as I said. We need one more thing. We need inclination, by the way, just because we need the luminosity of the disk, so we need the accidental orientation of the disk on the sky. But we need one more thing. We need a model of the flux as a function of radius. And for that, we use the Novikov-Thorne model, as indicated here. This is flux versus radius. Say for spin zero, the flux goes to zero. This is a very simple analytic model. It assumes that the torque at the ISCO is zero. There's no dissipation at the ISCO. And as the spin goes up, this ISCO radius moves in. There's a number of requirements for this method to work, and they're all, again, described in this review article in detail. But the emission from the thermal disk is not black body. It's black body-like. It's a dilute black body. So one has to make a spectral hardening correction. We rely on these people for this. We have to use disks that are thin, because if the disks get thick, the torque at the ISCO becomes large, and the thin disk model doesn't work. We assume that the black hole's spin is aligned with the orbital angular momentum vector. And finally, we need spectra that are dominated by the accretion disk. And to show you what that looks like, here is a gold spectrum, a very good spectrum, where of LMCX3, where you see that the thermal component is about two orders of magnitude above the Compton component. There's always some Comptonized radiation in these systems, and we have to model it out, but in a case like this, it's very negligible. And even if this Compton component is as much as 25% of the thermal component, we can get reliable measurements of spin. Can you tell me how much time I have left? Okay.
Oh, wait, no.
That sounds small.
That's called
the 5-minute warning. Oh, yeah, okay. I got 7 minutes until the 5-minute warning, is that right? Okay. Okay, I want to just make sure I get through things here. Okay, so these are the spins we've measured, and I'll come back to this, but there's three for the persistent systems, 7 for the transient systems. So we have mass and spin, so we have complete descriptions of these black holes. There's 2 provisional measurements of retrograde spin in 2 objects. I indicate them here. One thing about our method is that we have many independent measurements of spin, and for these black holes, we have this many independent measurements. For this one, we have 390 measurements. For this one, LMCX3, we can plot here the Eddington-scaled luminosity versus time over 27 years. And the data that are important or that can be selected by us are between 5% of Eddington and 30%. There's about 400 observations. And the luminosity is varying widely. And if you plot the inner disk radius and consider for a moment only the RXTE data, the inner radius is stable to 2% over more than a decade and over all these luminosity variations, which is an indication that there is a stable inner disk radius in these systems. Then the GRMHD simulations that Ramesh Narayan and his students have done show that the disk does terminate at the ISCO. Not exactly at the ISCO, as you would expect. There's some emission from within the ISCO, but the errors incurred in neglecting that are smaller than our observational errors in mass, inclination, and distance. So we don't use this model. We use the Novikov-Thorne model. Again, here's the table I showed you of all the spins. And an important takeaway is that for the persistent systems, we find consistently higher masses, significantly higher masses, and we find that their spins are all high. For the transient systems, we find that the masses are significantly lower and that the spins range all the way from zero to very high spin. So there seems to be a significant difference between these two classes of black holes. The two applications, I think I'm going to skip this because I don't think I have time to do this properly. So I'm going to go to the other method of measuring spin, the iron line method. So there's two. This is the one that's used for supermassive black holes. The continuum fitting method doesn't work well there. So this is an extremely important method to validate. Again, for the continuum fitting method, we're just measuring the continuum radiation from the disk. But in the iron line method, please understand, one is not only considering the thermal emission from the disk, but one must generate the iron line, which isn't generated in this cold disk. It's generated by the thermal emission being Compton upscattered. That's the blue radiation here. Some of it going directly to us as a power law, some of it going down, striking the disk, and fluorescing lots of lines in the disk to produce this reflected component. So there's a lot of atomic physics here. This is complicated. You're working in states of these X-ray binaries you don't know much about because you're working in highly Comptonized states as opposed to the thermal states we use for continuum fitting. The reflected component is this complicated thing here. This is the thermal component. This is the power law coronal component. And this is what you get the spin from, this spectrum here. And this is the iron K line, which is the crucial signature for getting spin by this method. And this shows how that iron K line gets broadened by these effects in the disk, including special relativity, Doppler boosting, Doppler effects, gravitational redshift, and then integrating over the disk. You get a line profile. So this is unbroadened, and then all these relativistic effects broaden it. And you get a line shape that in a model looks like this for three values of spin, where plus one, the spin of the black hole is in the same sense as the disk, and minus one, it's as fast as it can be going in the retrograde or opposite sense. And you see the profile changes, and for the extreme prograde case, you get a long red wing going to low energies, and it's that you model to get the spin. This shows an example from this very important paper, early paper by Brenman and Reynolds, and I call this the tender red wing, because if you want to determine the gravitational redshift and model this, then you'd better know that continuum extremely well, and that's a challenge for this method. The other challenges for this method are that right now all models assume that the ionization of the disk is the same at all radii, which is obviously wrong. It also assumes that the atmosphere of the disk is constant density, not hydrostatic. That's also wrong. And so these models are relatively complicated. This is a quick summary for supermassive black holes. This is more interesting to you for the Event Horizon Telescope. These are the measurements for supermassive black holes. This is from this little Springer brief book by Laura Brenneman. And you see how high all these spins are. Extraordinary, extraordinarily high. Now, there are some that are lower. Here they are. So here's the spins of 22 supermassive black holes measured by the iron line method. Now, I want to quickly come to the comparison. And I don't want to run over because I know we're already over. So far, six individual stellar mass black holes have been measured by both the iron line and the continuum fitting methods. And here are the results. For four of them, the agreement is quite reasonable. This is the number of observations for continuum fitting on the left in blue, and there's only typically one or two observations in the iron line. And two disagree. Okay, so that's the status of it right now. Now, on Cygnus X1, I would like to just show if this thing will work. What? Oh, what did I do? Oh, yeah, okay. I hit the wrong button. Yes, the case of Cygnus X1. In 2009, the iron line people found this spin, zero, essentially. In 2011, we found a very high spin for Cygnus X1. And then in 2012, the iron line people reported a very high spin. They have two values here that are quite discrepant, as you can see by the error bars. And these are the same authors. And in this 2012 paper, this result is not mentioned, is not discussed. So people say we disagree with the continuum fitting results with the iron line. And the answer is yes, because they also disagree. And we have, again, confirmed this very recently. So we are also getting involved deeply right now in the iron line business because it's extremely important because it's arguably the best way to validate both methods is getting consistent results between the two. So we're very interested in this work. And by the way, you won't be burdened by reading about systematic errors in the papers on the iron line methods of measuring spin in Cygnus X1. But if you read our paper, Cygnus X1 is a difficult source, you will read a lot about systematic errors. And we've discussed, for example, in section 5 here, a few pages in APJ, all of these effects. So in summary, the 10 measurements of continuum fitting for these stellar mass black holes, it's a simple state. Already people said this is what black holes would show, that is a thermal disk, even before black holes were known. I mean, this is what Lyndon Bell and others said back in the 60s. I didn't discuss the two applications, unfortunately. So there's some agreement between the iron line and continuum fitting at present, and a lot more work needs to be done on this to validate both methods, particularly the iron line method, which is really the only method that can be used wholesale to do the work on supermassive black holes. So that's it. Yeah. Was I on time?
You had 3 minutes left.
I did?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I didn't know that.
Well,
I was rushing.
Jeff was so worried he actually saved so much time. There's plenty of time for questions. So let's start actually with Elliot.
So two questions. One is, can you comment in particular about the ionization corrections for the iron line in black hole binaries, where the ionization states are probably, things are particularly ionized? And then second, can you just flash up a slide about this jets are powered by black hole spin energy?
Okay, so the ionization of the disk is a very big deal. It's a very important parameter. It changes significantly the appearance of the line. Presently, all models that have been run assume that the ionization is independent of radius. So that's the next step to do something there. And the biggest problem with the iron line method I didn't even mention is that one has no idea of the geometry of the illuminating corona. That is, whether in some papers you'll read, it's a slab over the disk, or it's a sphere, or it's the base of a jet, a lamppost. So the idea that, you know, the method is extremely important, needs a lot of work, needs to be brought in from various directions. Timing, studies of AGN, which are slow. One can possibly get something from reverberation effects to put constraints on the geometry of the corona. There's a lot that needs to be done. But I think that getting consistency between the two methods for stellar mass black holes is at least one good starting place. And as for this, so what we find is that for these Eddington limited outbursts, so only the brightest outbursts, that when one gets this radio peak here, if you take this to be a proxy for the jet power, then what we have found is that if you plot jet power versus the ISCO radius, then with only one free parameter, the normalization of the Blanford-Zinajec model, we can fit 5 of these continuum fitting spins over a range of a few hundred in jet power, not the 5 or 6 that Heino was speaking of. And the one thing here to remember is that we are only talking about those systems that are going to Eddington, and we're talking about the jets that are emitted at that time. And the objects that Heino was talking about, if I remember correctly, in the correspondence we had, are at, on average, 5% of Eddington or so. And also, if you think about the low hard state of these systems, the black hole systems, if you're familiar with it, they're at a couple percent of Eddington. And there you will have the fundamental plane of black hole activity, they call it, which plots radio luminosity versus mass and X-ray luminosity. And there is no obvious place for spin, just as in Heino's sample. But for these Eddington limited ones, we find this relationship. It's controversial right here.
So Jeff, the you mentioned the issue of checking both the continuum and iron line measurements by comparison, and the complication presented by knowing your continuum. So I had two very closely related short questions. The first is, was the evolution in Cygnus X1 spin a consequence of that continuum estimation? And secondly, my understanding is that for the supermassive black hole cases, the continuum is understood much better. Is it simply a power law? Is that true, or am I misinformed?
I think for the supermassive black holes that the situation is much better. One doesn't have a thermal component coming down and confusing things. It's just a power law. I think the work that's been done on the supermassive black holes is of higher quality, this is my opinion, much higher quality than the work that has been done on the stellar mass black holes to date. And what was the question about this? So the answer is, I won't give you a long answer, I'll give you the short answer. The short answer, Chris Reynolds, who is on both of these papers also, he's here and he's over here somewhere, he's on both of these papers. In his review of 2013 Space Science Reviews, he says that the problem with this earlier measurement, which they didn't say anything about in this paper, the problem is that there was pileup in the detector, meaning more than one photon arrived in one frame time in the CCD, and that pileup distorted the spectrum. But look at this error. That's what I said. No consideration of systematic error is like no error estimate at all, in my opinion, in this business.
Hi, Jeff. I'm wondering, just because of the sensitivity
there you are.
The spin measurement to the continuum, are you automatically biased toward high spin measurements? Because you're either going to detect it or you're not. And I'm wondering if the absence of a clear distribution there is just due to the systematic effects of trying to model the continuum.
So I wouldn't know if the continuum is being placed properly or not. That's an extremely difficult question, as anyone who's been in a high school physics lab and tried to do an experiment would know even already. It's just very hard to determine the continuum. I don't really know that. But what I would say is, the reason they get so many high spins, I think, is that when the iron line is present and easily detectable, let me be clear. I do not work on the AGN. I haven't, so I'm a little bit, So here's the deal. In the AGN, in addition to the broad iron line, there's almost always also a narrow component of iron line. And so if you have a very low spinning one, that narrow component can get confused in that broad, the broad component can get confused in the narrow one. And when you have a broad wing like this, you can more easily detect it. So I think there's an observational selection to find the high spin ones. But that's an opinion, because I don't work on that.
With that, I think we're ready for the coffee break. So let's thank Jeff and all the speakers.